and welcome to our latest edition of our Stevenson Harwood Employment Podcast. I'm Leanne Raven, Senior Knowledge Lawyer in the Employment Team. Today we are talking about redundancies. You can't have missed all of the headlines we've seen in 2023 about big household names making large numbers of redundancies. The economic climate with successive rises in interest rates has seemed to cause a lot of pressure on businesses and employers, resulting in huge numbers of layoffs. So today I have with me to discuss this topic Richard Friedman, partner of our employment team, and Natalie Edwards, managing associate. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Leanne. Thank you. Great to be here with you both. Absolutely agree. Really, really topical at the moment, more so than usual. We've seen it in the press with Thames Water, amongst others.
Yeah, absolutely. Hot topic and a lot of press around it, particularly as we're approaching Christmas. So, of course, it becomes the very negative headlines you get about for Deloitte. We're looking at 800 jobs. It's about 3% of the workforce being laid off. And there's obviously a lot of negative criticism about that, particularly this time of year.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're exactly right that it's got a lot of negative connotations, the word. And actually, I find quite a lot the word redundancy is thrown around when it might not be what we as lawyers technically mean as a redundancy. So just to kick off, it would be great to hear from you. What are we actually talking about from a kind of technical perspective when we use the word redundancy?
I think it's a really important point. I remember as a junior lawyer working on some redundancies, and one of the key points that was first raised is that actually when people think of what they think of as a redundancy, it immediately goes to cost saving. And of course, that is an element in many redundancies, but simply cost saving alone and cost saving itself and of itself is not actually mentioned in the relevant legislation when we're talking about the definition of redundancy.
I think the word redundancy has a lot of negative connotations with it, and it has to be used carefully. So often if employers are making dismissals, it's not, they would put a redundancy label on it, but actually it's not redundancy, and that can have very negative connotations within the workforce. So it's worth always ensuring that we're honest about the reasons that we are making the dismissals.
So what are we talking about when we're actually talking about redundancy itself for these purposes in the legal context?
So there's obviously three types. You've got business closure, workplace closure, and a reduced requirement for work of a particular kind. And those are the traditional definition for the purpose of unfair dismissal claims and statutory redundancy pay. I think it's worth bearing in mind redundancies are always about the role, not about the individual. So the focus is always on the role that the individual does within the organisation, and there's no need for that anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because I think often, and understandably so, it can feel very personal to an individual that they're being made redundant. But exactly, and I think that's something for employers to reinforce, that it's not necessarily them as an individual, it's the role that's being made redundant. There's no longer a requirement for that role, or there's a reduced requirement for that role. So yeah, that's a really good point. And so what about, you might have cases, and some of the headlines I talked about, those numbers were kind of in the hundreds of redundancies. Is there a difference whether you're kind of, you know, letting a whole workforce go or making them redundant, or just a couple of people?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And when you are talking about potential redundancies, there are certain questions that you want to be asking right at the start of that process, because there are some things that actually, if you've gone down one avenue because you think there are certain certain scenarios apply, that's going to leave you in a difficult position. So there are very much specific questions that you want to be asking right at the outset. How many people do you think are at risk of redundancy? Where are those people? Are they in the same office? Are they in different offices? How can they be grouped together in roles? These are all the sorts of questions that you want to be asking very much at the outset, because that is going to have a significant influence and impact on how you run a redundancy process.
The key numbers, of course, less than 20 employees, you only have to individually consult. 20 plus employees, you need to consider collective consultation, and that comes with a whole host more of a process that must be followed.
And there was a lot of, some of our listeners may be old enough to know, things that happened off the back of the previous recession when Woolworths closed and you could no longer go and get your pick and mix on the high street. That wasn't the only consequence of Woolworths closing, but actually it was the backdrop of a big case in relation to redundancy. And the numbers that, Natalie, you're talking about, what they link to is where an organisation is proposing to dismiss a certain number of people at a single establishment, with the Woolworths case essentially finding that broadly speaking, their different stores were single establishments. So whilst redundancies across the whole organisation and in some stores would have hit the trigger numbers, there would be some stores where actually the redundancies were less than 20 people and therefore collective consultation obligations were not triggered in relation to those single stores.
Yeah, so I think that's a really, really interesting point. And that Woolworths case, as you say, has been key. I think the term they use in the legislation is establishment, if it's at one establishment. So exactly looking at how redundancies will affect kind of different stores or different offices is really important. I know that the legislation also talks about, for these collective redundancy purposes, they talk about proposing to dismiss. I think that can often be a question from clients, sort of how early on in the process, if we're having initial conversations, is that a proposal or is it kind of further down the line when it's all kind of written up and got board approval? Can I ask you about what your thoughts are on that?
Yeah, it's a good point. So consultation has to begin before any final decisions are taken. Otherwise, there's just no point to it. It's not going to be a meaningful discussion with employees about ways in that you might avoid the redundancy, which is obviously the purpose of consultation. So if you're formulating a plan that's likely to result in dismissals, that's when those conversations need to start happening. Now, the reality we often see is that redundancies are needed. The cost saving is needed. The roles aren't needed. And so that proposal and having that consultation can feel a bit artificial because there is sometimes no way to avoid the need to make redundancies. But ultimately, consultation is about having a meaningful discussion with employees, as I say, about trying to find ways to avoid redundancies. And that language about proposal and not settling on that actual redundancy plan until you've got through that consultation is really key.
Okay, so the consultation, it being meaningful, that seems that that's kind of one of the most important things. But is there like a specified time period you have to consult for, or is it fluid?
Yeah, so coming back to those numbers I talked about, so if you've got between 20 and 99 employees who are at risk of redundancy within that 90-day period, consultation needs to begin at least 30 days before the first dismissal takes effect. If you're looking at 100 or more employees, then it's at least 45 days before the first dismissal takes effect. And I think it's worth highlighting that it's not that period isn't a need to consult for the entire 45 days or the 30 days, but it's just that the dismissal can't take effect until that time frame has lapsed.
Okay, and I think, yeah, sometimes those time periods are thrown around, but there's a lack of understanding, so that's really, really helpful to point that out. So if you're making redundant between 20 and 99 employees, you mentioned, Natalie, that's within a 90-day period, then that's those time limits apply. Could an employer try and get around that by kind of batching up redundancies, by doing kind of 10 and then a month later doing another 20, et cetera?
I think there's a real risk if they do that and try and avoid it that way, Leanne. I mean, really, they need to be looking backwards as well as forwards, because they could fall into the trap of actually still falling within that 90-day period, albeit trying to have delayed things and working in separate batches. And that all comes back to planning these things in advance and really asking those questions right at the outset. How many redundancies or how many people are we proposing to dismiss? Where are they based? And then you can really work out the time frame, the timeline from that point looking forwards, rather than almost doing it slightly more ad hoc and then falling over yourselves to have subsequently realised that actually you might have accidentally fallen into the trigger numbers within that 90-day period.
Yeah, and obviously the risk of not collectively consulting, one of the key things, we'll come on to protective award available to employees, but one of the key things is the HR1 form, which is to notify the Secretary of State for Business Innovation and Skills that you're making this number of redundancies. And if you fail to provide that, it's a criminal offence. So the employer will be liable on summary conviction to an unlimited fine potentially. So it's really key to know if you are falling into that collective consultation territory.
Okay, I suppose that's the bit that often, employers' ears do prick up. But we might, be concerned about timing. And then when you realise actually that HR1 requirement can result in a criminal offence, it's not just us harping on about these timeframes. There actually are consequences. And can we just talk a little bit about what does a consultation process look like? So a collective consultation, what does that involve? Who is it with? Just some more detail around that, because I think that's really important for employers to be aware of.
Yeah, so, I mean, ultimately, collective consultation, it should be with a view to reaching agreement with the appropriate representatives of the employees on ways to avoid dismissals, reducing the number of employees who will be dismissed, and mitigating the consequences of those dismissals. And then there's the question of who are those appropriate representatives for the employees. In some cases, that will be obvious. You might have trade union involvement, in which case there are trade union officials who can do that job. Where there's no trade union recognition, then you're likely going to have to go through an election process where actually you are electing the appropriate representatives who you consult with on a collective basis.
Yeah, and the key with the representatives, there's no prescribed number that you need to have. So it depends on the groupings within your workforce. You need to have elected reps for certain. So if it's certain roles, certain levels, whatever it might be, it has to be based on the actual workforce who are at risk.
And picking up on that and the actual consultation process itself, I mean, you do want to be genuinely engaging in this consultation. You do want to be considering their suggestions and also thinking of your own suggestions on these factors around potentially ways of avoiding dismissals, mitigating the consequences. Really is important to engage with the representatives in relation to those matters. One, because it's the right thing to do, but also to protect the business from claims subsequently, you need to have gone through that process. We touched earlier on the unfair dismissal risk if you get that wrong in relation to redundancies and redundancy processes. That's not the only risk though, is it? Because there are very specific risks that arise from not consulting or not collectively consulting properly.
Yeah, the financial risk to employers is the protective award, which is up to 90 days gross actual pay for each affected employee. So the tribunals can start with 90 days and they work backwards, discounting for any meaningful consultation that has actually taken place. And it's worth bearing in mind that a protective award claim can't be settled under a settlement agreement. It can only be settled under a COT 3 with ACAS.
Okay, so we've got that on one side, the HR one, the criminal liabilities, and then here we're looking at the huge kind of financial sums. Can I ask you, you talked about affected employees, so it being a kind of award for each affected employee. What does the kind of the law say about who is an affected employee or not?
The affected employees are those who are affected by the proposed dismissals or might be affected by measures taken in connection with those dismissals. So it might not just be those at risk, it could be the wider workforce around that. So it's again working carefully to look at what the workforce is and who those individuals actually are.
Okay, so really important, like it's quite broad. It's back to those questions Richard said at the beginning, kind of really understanding and then really the meaningful consultation. So, you know, being able to show actually you have taken on board or you have actually carried out meaningful consultation. It's not just a tick box, otherwise you could be at risk of the protective awards.
Absolutely right, yeah.
And I think it's worth noting, we've spoken a lot about collective consultation, and that's right, because the risks are heightened with collective consultation, not least because of these protective awards, but also because you are dealing with more people. But a lot of these principles that we're talking about apply equally to individual consultation, where you don't have the numbers to trigger the collective consultation requirements, but you are still proposing to dismiss people, and there is a redundancy scenario. So there is a difference in some of the requirements that you have to go through. For example, you wouldn't need to put in an HR1 form. You wouldn't need to consult collectively, but the questions you're asking around ways to avoid dismissals, reduce the effects, apply equally really to individual consultation as they do to collective consultation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously you don't have the reps because the individual consultation you do between the employer and the affected employee in that scenario, but absolutely right, the consultation itself still has the same purpose.
Okay, and what else is kind of common to both processes, and what other features are there that you'd kind of carry out, whether it's an individual or a collective consultation?
So I think the actual process itself, and by that I mean, you know, identifying which roles are at risk of redundancy, how those people at risk are pooled with others. So, for example, you have five people doing X job and you have two potential redundancies from that pool of people. You want to be looking at all five of those and going through a selection process in respect of those five people. So outlining and really identifying the pool or each pool of roles which are at risk of redundancies or which have roles at risk of redundancy within the pool is very important. And that kind of leads on to selection criteria, which you apply to those pools.
Yeah, absolutely. So your selection criteria has to be fair and objective. It shouldn't obviously be discriminatory. So not kind of focusing on those with childcare responsibilities or those with long-term illness who have a higher sickness record, for example. So it's considering what your selection criteria are, making sure they're really objective and fair, and then applying those to each person in the pool to kind of come up with a score. So we work out who actually are the relevant individuals at risk. And even when those individuals are identified, it's worth noting they're not actually redundant at that point. It is still then part of a consultation process before that redundancy is confirmed.
Yeah, for example, you might be looking then at alternatives like finding whether there are other vacancies that that person who's been selected at risk could take, or internal redundancies to avoid that person becoming redundant, even though their role is disappearing.
Yeah, and it's and this is the thing about consultation, things like job share. You know, that may be somebody may come to you and say, you've put them at risk. They may say, well, actually, I'm willing to job share, and all of a sudden that becomes a possible outcome as opposed to the dismissal.
And you simply don't know if that's a possibility unless you've had that consultation.
Right.
And do some employers open the floor up for voluntary redundancies? There might be some employers who are actually quite happy to get a package and go do something new. Is that something you see a lot of?
I think it's a really good point. And I think that is something that should be considered right at the outset. I'm not necessarily saying that all employers should offer it, but I think they should be asking themselves the question, is that something we want to offer? Because frankly, for an employer, 9 times out of 10, I would say, it's better to offer that and invite that at the start of the process rather than at the end, because it can actually alleviate some of the legwork. It can alleviate compulsory redundancies. The one thing I would say about it is do it in such a way that actually, if a person puts their hand up, you are not obliged to accept each and every individual who volunteers for voluntary redundancy. You're not obliged to give them the enhanced redundancy package. But absolutely agree, Leanne, it's something that employers should consider.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want your best employees being a flight risk, of course. That's the only risk that's associated with that. So absolutely right. You've got the option to say no.
Yeah, absolutely. That would, couching it in terms, it's just an invitation to kind of put your hand up if you're interested. Yeah, exactly. But not an offer that's going to be accepted, per se. So what else should employers be considering that stage in the process? They've done their pooling, they've done their selection criteria, they've got a bunch of employees who are at risk. What else do they need to be thinking about?
So the key thing is looking at suitable alternative roles in any of these processes, whether a collective or individual. At all times, you want to have an employer wants to have an eye to what other roles are available within the business. These individuals who are at risk, could they slot into other roles, either like for like in terms of skill set, making them a suitable alternative, or something else that they didn't automatically going to fall into, but they might be interested in, they could apply for, they could be interviewed for. So there is an important consideration in looking at what other alternative vacancies there are for these individuals. And of course, it's worth bearing in mind that those on maternity leave, adoption leave or shared parental leave have special protection, and that they have an automatic right to be offered any suitable vacancies if their roles are at risk of redundancy.
Yes, and actually, interestingly, that's an area we're seeing some changes. So the law is being extended to provide enhanced protection for pregnant women before they go on leave, and for those on maternity, adoption, or shared parental leave, extending the period till after they return from leave. So a really important area in which we are going to see changes next year. And if you do offer a suitable alternative of role, is there an opportunity for the employee to try it, or do they just have to accept or reject, or how does that work?
No, there should be, in many cases, a trial period. There's a statutory 4-week trial period if alternative employment is on different terms to previous jobs. Also, that links into actually what happens if someone unreasonably refuses an offer of suitable alternative employment. Because if an employee does unreasonably refuse an offer of suitable alternative employment, they actually lose their right to statutory redundancy pay. Obviously, unreasonable refusal and whether something is suitable alternative employment, they are questions within themselves. So you cannot simply offer someone any sort of alternative job on anything whatsoever. They say no, and you think you're off the hook as an employer to pay a statutory redundancy payment. That's not the case at all. But there are instances where that may be applicable.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, lots of kind of case law discussion around what is suitable and then what if it's reasonable or not to reject it. Exactly, that makes sense. Otherwise, it would be too simple, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing that employers should consider, but they're not obliged to do, is something called bumping. And that's not anything to do with dodgems or bumper cars at the fairground, but it's to do with actually, if an individual's role, if the role they are doing is at risk of redundancy, but for example, they could do another role within the team, then actually there is a question to be asked, should the person who is doing that other role be made redundant, and the person whose actual role is leaving almost be bumped into that other role, with the other employee doing the role which is not at risk of redundancy, actually being the person whose role is terminated. I should flag and appreciate that's a fairly convoluted explanation. Bumping is not an absolute requirement. It's not something you have to do. But again, it is worth considering whether it's a plausible option in the individual redundancy situation.
Yeah, I don't think we see it very often, actually, with clients. But yeah, it's always worth bearing in mind within a team structure, for sure.
Okay, so we've gone through the process and we've got to the point where an employee is confirmed as redundant and it's time to part ways. What do the employers need to be thinking about in terms of costs?
Yeah, so we've got to the point where the role is confirmed as redundant and the employee is going to be dismissed. So they will be entitled in a redundancy scenario to a statutory redundancy pay. And that's calculated based on years of service, age and a statutory cap on weekly pay. There's also potentially enhanced redundancy pay payable. So some employers will be more generous than the law obviously requires them to be. If that's going to be the case, and sometimes employers will calculate it based on, so for example, putting actual pay into that statutory calculation instead of the capped pay, or sometimes so many weeks per year of service to be more generous. And in that scenario, we'd always advise clients to wrap up that departure in a settlement agreement just to ensure in return for any of those enhanced redundancy pay, all claims are waived.
And then on top of that, you will have either the notice period or payment in lieu of notice, depending on how the contract is drafted. There will also be either accrued but untaken holiday that you will need to pay out on termination, or if employees have actually taken more holiday than they've accrued, then actually in some instances that can be offset against some of the payments that are made upon a redundancy.
It's probably worth on notice pay a flagging as well. So if an employee whose role has been confirmed as redundant is remaining in role and serving their notice, there is a statutory requirement to continue looking for suitable alternative roles right up until the day their dismissal takes effect. So even within that notice period.
And also equally, that notice period can take someone beyond a threshold of continuous service, be that for unfair dismissal rights or actually accruing another year's service on their statutory redundancy payment.
Okay, so both really important points. And of course, you're only entitled to your statutory redundancy pay when you've had 2 years service. So yeah, really, really key to keep an eye on those dates. Right, well, that actually brings us to the end of today's podcast. So thank you to Richard and Natalie for sharing your words of wisdom on redundancies. And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in. As always, you can find all of the podcasts in our series on our Employment Hub, which is www.employmentlawweb.com. Thank you for listening.